K2 Romeo India Whiskey. K2RIW, my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee, K2KEY. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick make a valiant attempt to organize this rowdy group, sometimes rowdy group, very enthusiastic group of ham radio operators who meet most Sunday evenings and try to help each other. We try to teach each other how ham radio works, how the various components work, and over the last few months, in the later portions of the TechNet, we're getting into some rather basic physics. We're trying to understand at the molecular level what is magnetism and gravity and electromagnetic wave and photons. I'll admit that this kind of depth of material doesn't appeal to everyone, and we understand that. That's part of the reason why we put it at the end. In other words, for those who are enthusiastic enough to want to go that deep, beyond the first hour and a half or so, we start delving into that material. And I think it's an extremely educational process for those who are true scientist type. Let me drop for a minute. I'll explain what I mean by that. From my point of view, a true ham radio operator in many cases has a kind of a scientist built inside of him that's trying to get out, where he doesn't have quite the right education or the right occupation where he can carry that on. Not everybody can do that and make a living at it, but many a ham radio operator in the process of exploring how to build a better antenna or a better transmitter or a better receiver, a better low noise amplifier, a better transmission line, and so on, they are really delving into a kind of science. And if you want to, you can go one step beyond that and try to understand what is the mechanism behind the curtain, if you know what I mean, how those things work. But for the first hour and a half, we try to treat more light subjects. We claim this is the brand new technical net, where during the first hour, everyone who signs in with a question gets at least a brief answer. That's what we try to do. Sometimes I fail on that one, and various people bring it to my attention. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So please give me your check-ins at this time. K2RIW listening.
And 2EO, Dick. And 2EO.
I wonder what his name is. I'm going to call him Rich. That's very fine, Rich. Anyone else?
KC2RKK. Yes.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Okay, we got RKK and MDC, Steve. MDP, I think it is. I'm terrible here. Steve. Mr. RKK, please tell me your name, sir.
Sorry, it's Steve.
Okay, Steve number one and Steve number two. So we got Rich, Steve, and Steve. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2WGB with an antenna question.
His report later on in the net. Okay, we got John. We've got a series of questions. And there was a KC4 who said later in the net. Please give me those call letters again, because that was a double. The KC4 later in the net. Give me the call letters and your name, sir.
Okay, that was me, Dick, WS2N Paul. I said, I have a space report for later in the net.
Okay, looking forward for that space report. Anyone else to sign in besides Rich, Steve, John, and Paul? Give me your call letters and name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Name and call letters right now.
KC2BUI, Sam.
Good evening. KC2KEY.
Okay, Mel recognized. Sam, your call letters were a little bit fast. It sounded like K2BUI, Baker Uniform India or Baker Uniform Yankee. I want to repeat that one for me, Sam.
KC2 Papa Uniform Yankee.
Okay, I got Papa Uniform Yankee. And what was the prefix before that, Sam?
KC2, Kilo Charlie 2.
Okay, now, thank goodness you gave it to me phonetically, Kilo Charlie. A little bit of distortion on your microphone or a little bit of noise in the signal, and maybe I'm not listening, Sam, careful enough. Okay, we certainly got Sam. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KB1, Victor Delta Bravo, this is Louis.
Houston 2 MV, no questions.
Okay, Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Lewis, I think you said. Oh no, Victor Delta Bravo, and name Lewis, and also November 2 Moon Bounce. And I hope that Barry will have some questions for us because he's a guy who really has done a lot of Moon Bounce. All right, is there anyone else that I'm lacking so far? Give me a call, letters, and name. Okay, we have more than enough to get going here for the first hour. And we're going to make a valiant attempt to squeeze everybody into the first hour with at least a brief answer. And if it's a deeper subject and what isn't, we hope to we'll go with those a little bit later. So we're right now, the plan of action is the first hour, at least a brief answer for all of the questions. Mel will go to his mailbag, hopefully before 9 o'clock, so we don't keep those kids up too late that are getting their ham radio license. Then Paul with his space report, and then we'll dig into the real stuff. Look out. Go ahead, Rich. N2EO, what's the latest in Whitestone? And keep that jingles happy. KQRIW, you got it, sir, Rich.
Okay, Dick, good evening. N2EO, name is Rich, QTH, Whitestone, Queens. Dick, I actually have two questions. One of them was what I planned. A second question, because we had some antenna work, me and Barry, today. If there's time, put me last for a second question, only if there's time. Otherwise, I'll hold it over for next week. Dick, what I wanted to discuss, and I touched on this last year, a Collins 62S1 transverter. For those not familiar with that unit, it's a transverter that takes in 14 megacycles, 20 meters, converts up to 2 meters sideband, 6 meters sideband, takes the received signals and converts them down to 20 meters so you can use it with like a Collins S-line or a KWM-2 transceiver. Let me let the repeater reset. Dick, last year when I got this thing, it was heavily used. It's in good shape, but it had a lot of miles on it. The original tube in there and the output was a 4X150, which was really in bad shape. I put a 4CX250B in there, and over the winter I noticed it was going flat on me. I never thought I'd flatten a 4CX250. Running 800 volts on the plate. I think, I didn't measure it, but I think it's about 250 volts on the screen. I had a brand new 4X150 that I put in, and what I noticed right away was the emission was down on the 250, because when I put the brand new 150 in, I had to tweak the bias control, because the idle current was actually higher. So that tells me that the old tube, the emission was flat. The power came back up. I did some alignment on it. Let me get a reset. What I wanted to ask you, Dick, it's kind of old technology, but of course they're still using that tube today. You used it in the 70s on 432 with the RIW. Parallel kilowatt. Collins rates the 62S1 165 watts PEP input, 65 watts typical output. That seems like awful low efficiency. And what I noticed here, according to the IMAX specs, they say 250 mils of plate current is maximum. On 2 meters, it was drawing a shade over 300 mils, and I think that's why I flattened that tube. With about 90 watts out, 800 volts on the plate, I think about 250, 290 on the screen, I was getting less output on 6 than on 2, about 65 watts. So that seems odd that at a lower frequency, I guess it should be the other way around. What I was thinking of doing, I don't know if I'll do it before the DX season on VHF and UHF or hold off, but they've got a switched coil arrangement in there, a series parallel arrangement. to switch the Pi network on 6 and 2 meters. And they're using what looks like silver-plated number 10 wire. I was going to redo those coils and make them number 8. Maybe there's losses in those circulating tank currents. Also, Collins did not use an IMAC SK620 or SK630 air system socket with the built-in bypass capacitors. They used their own socket. They've got eight 20 picofarads each, three of them off the screen and some resistors off the cathode, the 1,000-ohm resistors, 12 each? I can't see what they are right now. But I was going to get rid of that and put an air system socket in there. And I wonder what you think of the efficiency is likely to come up. Also, the output coupling loop, you know, link coupled output through a 100 picofarad variable capacitor, and that goes to the output. That's the loading capacitor. I would probably leave that. What I was thinking of doing was making the coupling variable. I'm sure you've seen that done. What they do is they take a fiberglass and a lucite shaft, put a coil on it, so the coil can be halfway, one quarter, three quarter way meshed into a coil that is coupling into, almost like a variometer arrangement, so you could optimize the coupling. I wonder if you think it's worth the effort, if I'm going to gain anything, because, like I say, I'm pulling 300 mils at 800 volts, that's about 240 watts in, I'm getting about 85 watts out on 2, I'm getting about 65 watts out on 6, with about 270 mils. I need the power dick to drive the amplifier on 6. That's why I want to do it. I'm building up a pair of 3500s, which require a good 110 watts on 6 meters. Back to that, N2EO.
N2EO, KQRIW in the groove. The 4X150 and 4CX250B series of tubes, the external anode tube, which I think was first invented by RCA, but I'm not sure. And the 4CX250B has got ceramic for the insulator. The 4X150 has got glass for the insulator. The 4X150 and 4CX250B, the glass and the ceramic, are essentially identical tubes up to 150 megacycles. The glass version, the 4X150, which really has 250 watts of dissipation on that plate, it's the exact same plate, as long as you're moving enough air through it. They're essentially identical up to 150 megs. Beyond 150 megs, you get a much higher power output with the 250B, the one with the ceramic, because glass becomes lossy at frequencies above 150 megs. The real point I'm making here, though, is that series of tubes is extremely rugged. As long as you don't do one or two things that are detrimental to the tube, which would be run the filament at very wrong voltages, too low or too high. Too high would be the one that would kill it the fastest. As long as you haven't put high filament voltage on the tube, and as long as you haven't run the screen grid voltage above 12 watts of dissipation per tube, screen current, I should have said, then that tube is... You can beat it with a hammer, so to speak. You can't kill that tube. The fact that you had it set at a bias of 300 milliamps versus 200 milliamps, that's a red herring, Rich. You could be setting that bias current at 400 milliamps if you're moving enough air through it, and you're not going to hurt that tube. And whether or not you're hurting the tube with overheating it, and by the way, higher bias current with or without higher voltage or improper resonating, where the tube is not... really producing all the power output that's proportional to the current and voltage you're putting in, that just makes more plate, the thermal temperature, more dissipation. And if you have any doubt...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you have any doubt that you're beating up that tube, all you got to do is take a candy thermometer and measure the air temperature that's coming off that tube. And if the air temperature is, let me pick a number, 250 degrees Fahrenheit or less, you're treating the tube very well. You can't beat it up. So where that tube appeared to be going flat on you, it could have been a defective tube. Maybe it had a questionable history or whatever. 4CX250Bs and 4X150s used to be the Don, many of them around, that people collected the Don things. One way or another, you'll be able to get a hold of more of those tubes and do a little bit of a substitution test. So I think it's a red herring. You did not damage that tube, as long as you didn't put fiercely wrong filament voltage and or 12 watts of control, here we go, screen grid dissipation. And that combined with, even I've seen cases of where guys have run that tube by mistake for like a minute at a time at full 250 watts of dissipation with no air flowing through it, where the silver plating on the anode structure became all blackened and whatever. You think the tube is really ruined. And you beat it up like that, and you go out and measure the tube, and you're amazed how well the darn thing works. So that's a red herring. When it comes to more power output on either of those bands, let me drop. I believe the 4X150 is capable of having 1,500 volts on the plate. The 4CX250B is capable of having 2,000 volts on the plate, with numbers like 250 milliamps of standby bias current, or current when it's running, if you know what I mean. You wouldn't be biasing it that high, I don't think. Anyhow, you want more power output from that tube by raising the plate voltage and or raising the screen voltage. The current capability, the peak current capability, which really gives you the peak power output, is a function of screen voltage to the 3/2 power. You go from 250 volts on the screen to 350 or 400 volts on the screen, and man alive, does that tube come alive and start producing power output if you've got the proper loading. In the case of your network that switches from 6 meters to 2 meters, I worry a little bit. If it's one of these networks where they short out some of the turns by a big rotary switch in order to raise the resonant frequency of the circuit, the plate circuit, from 6 meters to 2 meters, I worry about the fact that that switch that does that shorting of a turn, that that's the method they're using for raising the lowering the inductance of the PI network inductor and raising the frequency of resonance, that contacting switch better have milliohms of resistance or less. It better be a very healthy set of good silver-plated contacts or whatever. That's the one thing I worry about. A PI network on 6 meters and 2 meters is capable of giving you plenty of power output, plenty of efficiency if it's built correctly. If you go from a 10-ohm, a 10-gauge wire to an 8-gauge wire, let me drop. I think the improvement would be very little. And if there is any improvement to be had, there's a simple science experiment you can do, and that is run a T down for 60 seconds, turn everything off, and go in there and touch the 8-gauge or the 10-gauge wire. If it's essentially cool to the touch, then going from 10-gauge to 8-gauge, for that wire to dissipate the kind of wattage you're talking about, it would glow. So you don't even have to touch it. You just look at it and see if it's glowing, if you know what I mean, if smoke is coming off of it. To build a variometer-type output network instead of a PI network, go ahead and do that if you want to. In my opinion, it's not going to give you more efficiency. A properly built PI network is capable of 98% efficiency, if you know what I mean, if it's built correctly. And if it's not built correctly, there's a couple of experiments you can do step by step to find out where the power is being lost in your PI, if that's what it is. So don't jump into these conclusions, in my opinion, Rich, where you start blaming method A versus method B of making a plate resonant circuit, and whether or not 300 milliamps of plate current versus 250, these are minor details. With proper drive, with proper voltages on screen and plate, and with a properly operating PI network, those tubes are capable of many hundreds of watts of power output. Been there, done that, and that's what the April and May issue 1972 QST magazine, that's the so-called 432 parallel kilowatt amplifier by this guy named RIW, those 250B tubes can easily crank out 700 watts for a pair of them at 432. That's at least 350 watts per tube if you got the right plate voltage going there. So go step by step, and you don't have to go into these branched off extra science experiments, in my opinion, Rich. But maybe you do want to get yourself another tube, because I don't think you damaged the tube. I think the tube itself had a failure. N2EO,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
N2EO, KQRIW. Go ahead, Rich.
K2KEY with some comments.
Go ahead, Mel, with your comments.
Mel is an old Collins guy. Go ahead, Mel.
K6TPZ also with a comment.
Okay, we'll get to everybody's comments. All right, first of all, the difference between the 150 and the 4X150A and the 40X250B was the intellectrode capacitance. Now, that unit that Rich is working with, there was a number of experiments done by Collins people themselves, and I have heard about a number of the experiments. I only briefly owned the 62S1. Briefly, I had it for a while. I really didn't do much with it. However, they had pushed them at up to, as Dick says, quite a bit more power. 500 watts CW service and a 300 watt AM service back in those days. And they said the only constraint that they said at the time was the some of the components in there, the caution that when they started pushing the plate voltage up and all, that they said that, of course, you've got to be careful because the limiting factor at that time was the maximum voltage rating of, like, for instance, the bypass capacitors, the tuning capacitor spacing, and the breakdown of the material just in general. That was the constraint that they had in that unit, Dick, over.
K6TPZ with a comment.
Yeah, Hal recognized, and thank you for the information there, Mel. And by the way, also, I forgot to mention, Rich, when it comes to the socket used on 6 and 2 meters, the homebrew socket that Collins did, I don't think that's a factor. Later on, after you finish doing a bunch of experiments, for your peace of mind, if you want to go through all the effort of converting over to an SK630 or 620 type socket, the one with the built-in screen bypass capacitor made for UHF service, it may make neutralization a little bit easier, but I don't think you're going to see, with proper tuning of all the other networks and proper use of the tube and proper voltages, I don't think you're going to see a substantial difference in efficiency or power output because you change that socket. You would have to change the socket if you're using it on 432, but on 6 and 2 meters, I think you'll get away with it. Hal, K6DPZ, go ahead, K2RIW.
K2RIW assessment at K6DPZ. Okay, first off, I've worked with many 62S1s. I know that transmission through them very well. And I mentioned the risk, so I don't want to check this. That tube is very critical to grid drive. Now, he's getting more power on VHF than, let's say, 6 meters, more opportunity. So it leads me to believe he has some drive problems, which I mentioned to him to check the grid drive, very essentially on that, because it has a potential curve on grid drive. And he may find his problem with the drive is causing the problem of less output. It's easier to get high power on 6 than on 2. And Mr. IW, I think you agree with me on that. The right spelling, right?
Under normal circumstances, I would think I would agree with you, Hal. Most of the time, you're going to get more power and more gain on 6 than 2. However, and I'm going to pass it over to you in a second, Hal, and anything you do to increase your audio, you're a little bit noisy. What's your method of evaluating, in other words, measuring, is it the 3 watts of drive or 2 watts of drive or whatever? How do you evaluate the drive that's getting to the grid is question number one. But that tube will have a tremendous increase in gain, where even an inadequate amount of drive will give you more than enough power output as you start raising the screen voltage. If the screen is now running 250 and you go to 350 and 375, that tube might go from 13 dB of gain to 17 dB of gain, if you know what I mean. It really comes alive. So there's other parameters you can play with that. Back to you, Hal, for some further comments. K6DPZ, how do you evaluate the amount of power getting to the grid? K2RIW in the group.
K2RW through K2CCC. Okay, the male power gain the grid of the Putin 92 RMS voltmeter with the divider head on it. 161 divider head, 3D RF drive voltage. That's how it evaluates the power getting to the grid. Also, if the screen is set down about 250 volts or less, if I do not look at my notes right now, the tube would drop off rapidly with drop off of grid drive. So as I mentioned to them, look at the grid drive first before anything else. Because I've seen problems in the 62S1 where the grid drive is insufficient. You get a lot of power on VHF, 2 meters, but 6 meters would not be that good. It's due to alignment, degeneration, driving stages, and a lot of factors on that. But I don't know how many of you work on. I've worked on a lot of 62S1.
Okay, so to repeat what Hal was saying, because the signal was so noisy, he's recommending a voltage divider network in order to measure voltage being applied to the grid, which gives you a pretty strong hint as to what the drive power is. It's not really measuring power, it's measuring voltage and converting it into power, which is a pretty good technique. I'm going to have to move on, Rich, because we got a total of 5 guys who signed in, and if you're willing to hang around later on, we can come back to your situation. But as I see it, you don't have to make as many changes as you think right now, but if you do the right changes, you're going to get more bang for the dollar. And I think it's a voltage situation and making sure you've got a healthy tube. Back to you for a quick final, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Real quick, I was looking on eBay. I'll try and keep it short. If I do purchase another tube, there's a number of people that have 4CX250Rs, and I believe it's, what is the number, an 8930 or an 8950? It's one or the other. The number escapes me. It's got a bigger anode. Would you recommend one of those? I'll be brief. And the other thing is Barry, N2MB, who checked in, forgot. He told me he had a question. He wanted to ask you about a 3CX800 because I told him there's Henry amp on eBay for 6 meters. So he had a question there. I think he forgot. My good friend of 35 years forgot about his own question. So you can add him to the list. Go ahead, Nick, N2EO.
Yeah, there is a little bit of difference between the control grid capacitance and the plate capacitance on the 4X150 versus the 4CX250B. And a little bit more capacitance you'll have on the plate circuit for the 4CX250R. R means ruggedized. There's an extra support structure in there so the tube can tolerate high G forces sideways and backwards, up and down, and whatever. I've used the 4CX250Rs. You have to do a little bit of retuning and re-resonating because of the extra capacitance, but they put out the exact same amount of power. It's a hypervience tube, so you get a healthy tube, whether it be a 4X150, 250, or 250R, and put the right voltages on it, and that darn thing will sing. And step by step, if you've got any suspicion that your socket is giving you trouble or your Pi network is giving you trouble, there's ways of finding out real fast. The only way the Pi network can not give you full power output is that because one of the tuning or loading controls runs out of range, and you can easily find out whether or not you've gone full clockwise or full counterclockwise with a tuning or loading control, if you know what I mean. If it hits resonance with the right plate current and you don't run out of range, you can't blame it on the Pi network. On the assumption that something is not glowing in there and giving off smoke, and you'd smell that right away. So when you're talking about this number of watts, your Pi network can't dissipate more than a couple of watts where you'll find out right away. Let me drop where that waste is coming from. In my case of my 4CX250B amplifier that I built earlier on 6 meters, I had a variable capacitor for tuning, which was really not rated for that service, where I was running half a kilowatt of input, and it would occasionally arc over. And I had the choice in this very compact amplifier I built of, bulging it out to one side and putting in a bigger air variable capacitor with greater spacing on the plate so it didn't arc over. A simple solution for me was put sheets of Teflon in between the plates of the air variable capacitor. it tuned a little bit differently, but that stopped the arcing. As long as you use virgin Teflon, brand new Teflon, if you use recycled Teflon, which has microscopic holes in it, you get the arcs all over again. So there's some crafty solutions, but the right drive, as Hal was telling you, and the right voltages, that amplifier is going to sing. Just make sure you're moving enough air through the tube. And if the air coming off the plate circuit is less than 250 degrees Fahrenheit, then that's not a problem. We've got to move on. Steve, number one, is the next guy. Steve, KC2RKK, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. This is KC2RKK, Steve. Happen to be in Northport Village now. And I have a rated radio, an HF radio, in the high desert here in California City. And I was anticipating thunderstorms in the area. And so I disconnected my coax to my equipment. And I just dropped it down. And I believe I pulled the plugs on the power as well. Although I don't really remember doing that. But I left the room, came back a few minutes later to hear a sparking, buzzing sound. And I just observed sparks coming from the end of that coax, touching the middle frame of the typewriter table that I had everything set up on. There was a steady spark, very small, but steady spark coming. And it just, to this day, I never had an answer to what was happening. I was just assuming that somehow or another, the tower outside the building was catching static from that thunderstorm, and it was sending it down the coax. I just don't know if there was a dangerous thing or whatever, but when I connected everything back up again, it went away.
Very fine, Steve. I spent some time in California in the high desert of Palmdale, and why can't I think of the name of the town? It's just north of Palmdale, when I was doing some work at Edwards Air Force Base, 2,000 feet up. The Antelope Valley, as it's called. That's one of the areas of high desert, and they don't get rain there very often, but occasionally they do. Where you had disconnected the coax cable, and I've had that exact happen to me. Not there. I've had it happen to me on Huntington, Long Island, where I live, which is not too far from Northport, which I think is where you are right now. When lightning comes along and you get a lightning strike nearby, if you've got a direct lightning strike on your tower or on your antenna, you would know about it. There would be no doubt. Because when that lightning bolt comes roaring down that cable, it's going to make a huge spark and probably do some damage somewhere in the shack. If you get a direct hit, there's not very much protection. There's various protection devices you can put on cables and for the 110 volt power and cables for the coax, which will give you some assistance in lightning protection. But when a lightning bolt hits nearby, it creates something called an electromagnetic pulse. That means a very strong local magnetic field and a very strong local electrostatic field. And your cable and your antenna will pick some of that up. And when the voltage is high enough to exceed 76,000 volts per inch, you'll get an arc, and it'll arc to whatever it thinks is grounded nearby. And the fact that it arced on the outside of your equipment with the cable disconnected, I think the chances of it doing any damage to your equipment is fairly small. The worst damage I have ever suffered, because I live on a piece of land that I carefully chose, 300 feet above sea level, and I got 100 feet of power on top of that. You think I'm the local lightning arrester. Well, I've been here for 40 years, and I think I got struck once. And that one time I did get struck, one of my 110-volt cables in the shack, the ground lead, the return lead, became an open circuit on one of the 110-volt wires in the shack. That's with antennas connected to all of my equipment. So on that particular lightning strike, none of the ham equipment was damaged per se. The rotator that operated the television set got damaged. The television set got damaged. All the computers in the house got damaged. The internet connection got damaged. And it looks to me like the majority of the damage was a great big spike that occurred on the 110-volt line. If your eyes operated, let me drop one more point here. If your eyes were operating like a lightning bolt and you looked top view at the town where you live, Steve, you would see this vast network of wiring, which is the Long Island Lighting Power Company, if you know what I mean. All of that vast distribution wiring is a huge set of monkey bars scattered all over the town. It's a huge target. 99% of the time when lightning strikes something, it's going to strike the 110-volt wiring circuitry and the high voltage equivalent to it. Your antenna, your tower, and your antenna that in your eye is a very strong, high piece of metal that you think is going to be the target. To a real lightning bolt, that's an extremely strong, a very minor target, a very rarely hit target, because it's got so much other metal around it, all the 110-volt wiring. So if you were going to protect yourself from lightning and you want to hit the tall pole in the tent, as they say, do all the protection you can on the 110-volt wiring first. And if you want to be super safe and you think a lightning storm is coming along, it's a good idea to disconnect your cables from your ham equipment. It's not going to, and with rare exception, it's not going to damage any transmitting, but the receiving circuits on the front end, yes, they are a little bit delicate, and replacing them, a blown-out low-noise RF transistor on your receiver would be a bit of a pain. So disconnecting those cables is a safe thing to do if your lightning is coming along. But the 110-volt wiring is where 99% of the damage occurs when lightning hits your town. That's a bunch of opinions, Steve, but that's those are the opinions I've developed over the 40 years I've lived on top of a hill on Long Island. On the highest part of Long Island is 390-some-odd feet, and that's 4 miles away from my house, and I live on a piece of 300-foot above sea level land. K2RKK, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Steve. Wait for the beep.
That's who we are, Dick.
Rich recognized, but Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you very much for that explanation. But the thing that really caught my attention was the fact that it was bright and sunny. I never did hear any lightning in the background or the distance. And just kept, arcing from the end of that cable to the end. Just wondering if it was picking up, if it in fact was picking up activity from the thunderstorm. Probably way off in the distance because it was bright and sunny, and I just didn't know if that was the case.
Very fine, Steve. That is a very unusual situation. There are times when you get a very dry wind blowing over a desert area and you get a static charge built up on a well-insulated antenna, an antenna that is really not grounded. If your coax cable had been grounded in some manner, it wouldn't get a chance to build up the static charge that occurs when a very dry wind blows over an antenna. And yes, when a thunderstorm is miles away, it's kind of amazing that high voltage can be in the vicinity of you when the wind blows in the right direction, even though you've got a bright, sunny day. Weather can be strange stuff. I've also seen on my 100-foot tower water running down the legs of the tower on a bright, blue sky, sunny day. It must have been rather high humidity at the top of the tower, and as the super-saturated air struck the tower, the water condensed, and water was running down the legs of the tower. As I said, weather is strange stuff. Rich, you had a comment on this, N2EO, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I guess it's just luck of the draw because, about 6 or 7 years ago, I had a vertical up there on the roof. It was on a mast, highest thing in the area, because I'm on a slight hill. It's a slight incline up from the water here. And if I look out the north bedroom, I can see the very tops of the Schwarzenegger Bridge. The houses are all the same height. There's a school across the street. and the antenna is absolutely the highest thing in the area. Well, that antenna was up maybe a year. It turned into a crispy critter. We had a lightning strike here. The antenna wound up in half of it in the neighbor's tree, and it was all splintered fiberglass, burned. My neighbor next door actually saw the hit. I had some minor damage because I had some very good grounding. The only thing it took out... All right, let it reset. The only thing it really took out was the... it burnt up the band switch in an Ameritron tuner. And Barry, N2MB, has that tuner now. And he changed the switch. And everything is working fine. But by the way, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to ask you some more about grounding. We went into that last year because I have the new tower up. I had an electrician run conduit down the side of the house with ground wires and have rods in the front and back, and I have an air gap up there. I think, you know, it pays to be cautious because with the weather changing, I've noticed the lightning has been less frequent, but when we get it, it's more severe. Back to you, Dick, and to Leo.
Okay, we had a triple on that one. Go ahead, Hal, with your comment.
Okay, Dick, I just wanted to say the comments I made about the Richard's problem, I don't think you really understood what I said because of my signal. When you get done with a couple of the other people, get back to me, and I want to go over a few things with you again on that, okay?
Okay, heard you. Did I hear an N2SVR signing in?
KC2ERR.
KC2ERR, do you have a comment on this particular subject? Give me your name. Go right ahead.
No traffic. Just checking in. Angel over here, JF Kennedy.
EY, comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. No, that part of well is out there. One was considering taking a job out there at that area. A friend of mine out there that I went out to meet up with worked out there in a place called Bakersfield. And he told me, he says, a lot of times when that wind comes off the desert, there's something in that, the way that sand blows in that dry climate. He says creates the static. He says the static is unreasonable. And he says, at that point, he says, I turned the radio off real quick, ground everything. He says, it seems like it's something to do, believe it or not, with just the fine sand being blown by that wind, Dick, over.
I believe that, Mel. I've been reading quite a few stories these days about how does a charge get built up in a cloud during a thunderstorm. And whenever you've got fine particles, whether it be fine particles of aerosols or dust, or in the case of the high desert area of California, which is Palmdale, Bakersfield, Lancaster, Rosemont, Lake Los Angeles, been there, this high desert area, 3,300 feet up, where you can get humidities of like 5%, and on a certain kind of a windy day, you get dust devils and a very fine dust being blown around. Boy, can that build up a static charge. And so simply grounding the coax cable, the outer shield, would stop an awful lot of that buildup from happening. But if your antenna is truly floating in an environment like that, it can build up many kilovolts of voltage, and maybe tens and hundreds of kilovolts of voltage, and that can arc some pretty hard distances, pretty long distances, and scare the daylights out of you. There are some solutions to that. We got to move on. Steve, KC2MTP, the next Steve number two. Go right ahead, Steve, with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Radio check.
Steve, number, there's a net in progress right now, so we're not going to do a radio check. Steve, KC2MDP, go right ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, very good. Thank you very much. I'll throw this question out to the net, and I'll throw it out to you, too, for the final part. Basically, I've recently set up a DSTAR system on 23 centimeter. And, you know, I'm having limited success. know, I drove towards the city. There's one repeater that's supposedly on the Empire State Building, which I could not access. But as I got closer, I had some success with some repeaters in Jersey. So what I was thinking is, rather than moving around, what I do have is I have a 23-centimeter beam, 22-element M-squared, which is about 60 feet in the air. I was wondering if I could hook that to a scanner, basically program it to the frequency that I'm trying to receive off the repeater, drop the squelch all the way down. Will I hear any kind of carrier on the FM mode? Back to you, Dick.
And this is all with reference to D-Star mode of operation, which I know very little bit about. So the D-Star experts out there, that's where Steve is posing this question. So with his 23-centimeter 22-element, I think it was, Yagi at the 60-foot level, in the FM mode, will he, with the squelch disabled, so he's hearing the noise in the background, will he pick up D-Star signals if they exist? That's what I think the question is. Did I get your question correctly first? Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, pretty much, Dick. Let me clarify. This is a mobile installation right now. So what I was thinking of doing is, like I said, I tried it, and I didn't get anything off it, but I was wondering, you know, I know I'm not going to hear any audio, but I should I see some sort of carrier, you know, should the S meter go up, let's say if I use my ICOM 910H, which is a, 20, it has the 23-centimeter built-in, which is FM and sideband. Back to you.
I think he should hear a loud buzzing sound. That's what he should hear.
Yeah, Dick, K2DIG has been down for months. I know the 440 on the Empire State Building has been down because they had to send the controller to ICOM. Now, I don't know if that controller is common to 70 centimeters, 23 centimeters.
Okay, Barry, sounds like you've been there. So, Barry, take your time. Tell Steve whatever you can about D-Star mode and what he should be able to hear, what it will sound like, and what's the ideal receiver, and so forth. N2MB. Take your time, K2RIW.
Okay, no, I really haven't spent much time with these. Actually, Richie has a little more than I have. But I do know what the carrier sounds like, and it's just a loud buzzing sound. It sounds like, almost like an AC buzz. It's a digital buzz. And Richie was correct. The repeater, local repeater, I forget the caller, he knows the callers better than I, but that has not been working for a couple of months now.
Yeah, he called the K2DIG. To your knowledge, Barry, at least on 23 centimeters or any other frequency that you think Steve, KC2MDP, might be able to listen in the D-Star mode, is there any repeater operational in the New York City area, in Steve's area, that he's going to be likely to hear some D-Star traffic? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Okay, Richie could correct me on this. I think the Staten Island one is on 23 centimeters, Richie. Is that correct? And there's another one in Jersey, but those are the only two in the area. The other one is not working. So if the one in Staten Island is 23 centimeters, he should be able to hear it. I don't think he'll hear the one in Jersey. What do you think, Richie?
Well, 70 centimeters is in Staten Island. I don't know the call letters of frequency. He'll have to look that up. Jersey is 1,200 megs, 23 centimeters. When I had my ID1 here, I was able to get into it. That's Gene, W2KJI, from KJI Electronics. He's very involved with D-Star in New Jersey. From Whitestone, I had no trouble hitting it with an ID1 and a vertical, so he could try that. I don't remember the frequency. It's been a while since I've been on there. But if he calls Gene, W2KJI at KJI Electronics, he's a friendly guy. I'm sure he'll take time out and talk to him. Back to Ned.
Well done, Barry and Rich. So, Steve, as I see it, one of your best local experts is going to tell you the lay of the land, where the repeaters are, which ones are working, and whatever. Is Gene, Whiskey 2, Kilo, Juliet, India, of KJI Electronics. So by sending him an email and or a letter or a telephone call, I think you're going to get a lot more information. It looks like the amount of D-Star operation in the Long Island area is a bit light at this time. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. And thank you so much, Rich. You've made my day, because that's actually the repeater I was trying to go into, is K2DIG. I figured maybe I was a little bit too far, so I ended up driving across the George Washington Bridge into Jersey, and I did access two repeaters in Jersey. And I'm saying to myself, well, if I should be able to access two repeaters in Jersey, how come I'm not accessing the DIG repeater? You go on their website, and their website does say it is operational, but obviously not. Back to you.
So it looks like it's them and not you, Steve. And now you know why you weren't getting any action. Okay, we got to move on. John, KC2WGB, I think you've got a question. And I'll answer your question on anything except antennas, John. That's a joke. You got it, John, K2LAW.
Yeah, that figures, KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. No. I think I have a question on a little coffee can antenna that I made for 3 gig. I have a coffee can which is approximately 4 inches in diameter and metal, of course, and I've mounted an end connector on the side. And I lay it on its side. Inside of that, I put about a, tried it coiled up as a watch spring and also as like an open delta coat hanger. I cannot get it to come to resonance. Any tips? That's about it.
Okay. Since you said you've got a coil of wire, it means, it makes it sound like you're trying to make a helical exciter for a coffee can antenna. I'm looking for the right computer program I've got here. I'm trying to find out if a 4-inch diameter can is waveguide beyond cutoff at 4 gigs. And I think the, I mean 3 gigs, and I think the answer is no problem. And the conventional way of launching a linear polarized signal in there would be a quarter wave probe, if you know what I mean. Approximately a quarter wave probe, approximately a quarter wave from the back plane of the horn. Now, when you're trying to use a helical launcher, are you following somebody else's design, John, or is this a WGB original? Give me some more words on that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And so what's the polarization that you want to do?
Tried the watch spring style after I tried the open delta, like the coat hanger hanging in there, and neither one would resonate, and they're approximately 100 millimeters long.
Is there another person trying to break in and make a comment? Give me your call letters and your name, sir.
Tango Alpha Papa, this is Ron. Repeating the question is also regarding what he wants to do. Polarization is real critical, specifically of what he's trying to accomplish.
Tango Alpha Papa, what is your name, sir?
Ron. Romeo Oscar November.
Very fine, Ron. I have the impression where he is trying to make a helical excitation for the coffee can antenna, 4-inch diameter can. I presume you're trying to launch circular polarization. Is that what you're trying to do, John? Go ahead.
I'll take either one. Just the fact that I couldn't get it to resonate was driving me nuts. But I don't care about polarization.
This is W2CAP. Circular polarization would be the best design suggestion. So that's what I would recommend. Then you should be pretty good.
Okay, I just plugged in my program, a 4-inch diameter pipe, the first mode of resonance in the TE01 mode, correction, TE11 circular mode, is 1.73 gigahertz. And you're up at 3 gigs, no problem. The pipe is more than big enough in diameter. Now, when you helical antenna and you put it inside of a coffee can, you're going to make a substantial difference to the way it resonates. The helical resonator itself, have you ever tried feeding it outside of the coffee can with a ground plane behind it? Have you ever tried to first do that, John? Go ahead.
No, I did not, Dick. I did try it on the end connector in free air, but I did not try that with a reflector in back or any kind of a ground plane. Also, there are intrusions on this can in a radial direction which cause ribbing inside the can. I don't know if that's my problem.
Whoa, you just said a mouthful. Okay, you've got ribbing inside the can. Maybe it's time you give me a quick description of the can, John. I know it's 4 inches diameter. How many inches long? And what other kinds of hardware is inside of that can? Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, the ribbing is are just indentations in the can for the strength of the can. It goes around the diameter, the circumference of the can, for added strength. The can is approximately 8 inches in length of the cylinder itself. And those intrusions, of course, protrude inside the can and look like ribbing. If you were to run your hand in there, you'd be able to feel them. And they're approximately a quarter of an inch.
Okay, now I know what you're talking about. That's an extremely minor perturbation. To your eye, that looks significant. To that radio wave, a 3-gig radio wave is approximately 3 inches in diameter, 3 inches of wavelength, and that's not going to see these quarter-inch bumps unless the waveguide was very close to cutoff, which is at 1.73 gigs, as I remember, is the cutoff frequency. Anything more than half a gig above the 1.73 gigs, it doesn't stand a chance to see those ridges, so that's not a problem. When you fed the helix from a type N connector, the problem is you didn't really have a counterpoise. The way an antenna works is you're launching current into the antenna, but you can only launch current when you push against something. Very similar to the experiment I told you guys, make-believe Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in the cargo bay of the space shuttle. He's in orbit, he's in weightlessness. And assume he's a 200-pound man, and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand, and he pushes the 200-pound barbell 1 meter per second to the north. By action and reaction, his body will move 1 meter per second to the south because he's done that action. By the same token, when you're trying to launch current into an antenna, you're putting positive current into something, but the signal generator, even if it's the transmission line, has got to put negative current into something else that we call the counterpoise. In the case of a dipole, you'll launch current into one side versus the other side. The other half of the dipole becomes the counterpoise. So you need some kind of a ground plane around the type N connector. And the size of it almost doesn't matter as long as it's big enough, just a flat sheet of metal. And now you can make the helical portion work outside of the can first. And maybe that would help. And I presume your definition of working is what standing wave ratio you're seeing when you sweep in frequency. How far have you swept? How bad was the visor? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
I have the coffee can at one end of the bench, and about 10 feet away I have my HP power bolometer set up, and I was looking for the resonant peak, which I can usually always see as I sweep through the frequency. I was going about, I would say, from about 1.5 gig to 3.5 gig. I was making that sweep and I saw no indication other than like a background RF. There was no relevance of Q at all.
Okay, your power meter is trying to pick up what the antenna is radiating, and you probably know there's an inverse square law. In other words, every time you double the distance, you're going to get 6 dB less power. I presume your power meter is connected to some kind of a horn that's doing the reception. Some kind of an antenna that you know works at that frequency. And a power meter has nowhere near the sensitivity of a spectrum analyzer. If you had a spectrum analyzer, that would be a beautiful test. But with the lack of a spectrum analyzer, do you have the ability to move these two antennas closer together? What was the power meter connected to as a sensing antenna? Back to you, John.
I had a simple dipole antenna on it set at that frequency range. I also tried the same experiment with the spectrum analyzers using the input station, the spectrum analyzer, I could see a little bit of movement.